forbidden in Islam. And again, I ask the dear listeners to refer and ask the Marja Ta'lid that they follow, but generally speaking, this is the answer that is given by the scholars. It doesn't mean that, men and women are not allowed to have any relation. I'm talking about, when they are co-workers, for example.
We're talking about intimate relationship, not about professional.
Exactly. The professional relation is absolute. Of course, there are also some professional relationship to be followed when they are in a professional relationship as well. But when it comes to, such relations, this is the verdict that is given by the scholars. Now, the question is that then how, if this is not possible, how they are able to get to know each other if they are not going to be friends for some time? First of all, I believe that even in those countries where people are experiencing this relationship of boyfriend and girlfriend, girlfriend, even unfortunately among some Muslim communities, I believe that they have come to this conclusion that long friendships are harmful. And in most of the cases, they did not end up in marriage. And in most of the cases, the girls, and in some cases, the boys, they have, they have bad experiences at the end of the day. Mainly, I'm talking about the girls.
With jealousy, jealousy problems. And
exactly. Yeah, that's one of the problems. So what is the solution? I believe that according to the religion of Islam, one of the best solutions is the fact that they tell their families, their parents, about the fact that they want to get married maybe in future, and now they need some time to know each other. Maybe some people say that it doesn't make any difference, but I believe that when one's parents, they have this information, they know about these relations, then that relation is also somehow controlled. So the boys and the boy and the girl may go to, the boy's house, for example, and the parents know that, the parents of the girl know that, they may talk, for a couple of even hours, for example.
There's no problem with that.
And they, when the families know about that, for sure, these negative consequences that we talked about, unfortunately, especially some of the girls, they have gone through some of these negative
bad experiences.
It will not happen when the parents, when the boy knows that the parent, the girl's parents know about this relationship.
When they're involved, there is more guarantees for it to succeed.
Exactly.
Or to not succeed, but in a professional and a good formal way.
Exactly. So it could be, even as I mentioned, for a couple of hours, for a couple of weeks. And let's be honest in this regard that at the end of the day, even if you're a friend for 1 year, when you, we put it in Persian as go under the sailing, which means that when you get married, still you will see that there are some aspects that you did not know about your partner.
You can never know a person completely, even your very close friends.
So I believe that for marriage, you may consult the girl's or the boy's friends and neighbors and co-workers and so on and so forth to come to a conclusion whether he or she is a good partner or not. And talking to each other to know about the beliefs, religious beliefs, socially speaking, politically speaking, it can happen through, like, for example, let's say a couple of weeks, couple of hours. This excuse that we need to
get to know each other
for a long time, like for 2 years, 3 years, and
there's no guarantee. This is what I actually wanna say, that there is no guarantee that pre-marital relationships, that you know each other privately without the knowledge of the parents or with the knowledge of the parents and in the house. There is no guarantee there's no guarantee that your marriage will succeed.
Yeah.
The divorce rates are still high in the West and in the East and everywhere. There's no guarantee.
Exactly. But to prevent these negative experiences of boyfriend and girlfriend relationships, I believe that to let the families know about this relation is very helpful. They can get rid of some of those negative experiences through the knowledge of the parents. As I mentioned, when the boy knows that the parents, both parents know about this relationship, they come to see each other inside the house of the boy or the girl, and there are other people. So at least to a great extent, those negative experiences will not be there. Mm-hmm. And the other, suggestion that some of the religious families, they prefer is that, you know, that we have the concept of temporary marriage in Islam, of course, practiced by Shias Khilaf thought, but we believe that it was,
allowed in the time of the Prophet and exactly forbidden and in the time of the second caliph.
Yeah. So I'm not telling that this is a good suggestion for all the people. In some cultures, they may have a negative understanding of it. But
nonetheless, it is a suggestion
it's
possible.
It's a practical way because sometimes, of course, let me also refer to one fiqhi issue, the fact that according to the Islamic rulings, if the boy and the girl, they really want to get married, for once they can look each other without some limitations. I ask the dear listeners to go to the books of Islamic laws and to see about the limitations. But this is one of the great instruction by the religion of Islam. As I mentioned, if the families agree, the other solution for some families is that they become mahram for a short time, like, for example, 1 month, 2 months. Still, they have controlled relationships. They can mention the limits in the contract of temporary marriage. Mm-hmm. And they can, get to know each other during that period of temporary marriage.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Murtada. I repeat what the Sheikh told us several times. Please refer to your marja, taqlid, and find out for yourself what you are permitted to and not to. And this is your host, Haider Al-Bahadli. This is your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting from IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan.
Around the world with reporters.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
The head of Iran's delegation to nuclear talks in Vienna, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says there are still many technicalities that need to be resolved before a final agreement can be reached. Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA have been engaged in talks to bring the US back into the deal and to ensure Iran's full compliance since April. Iran says it will only implement its nuclear commitments after it verifies the effective removal of all US sanctions, including additional ones imposed under former President Donald Trump, who withdrew from the deal in 2018. Iran is seeking assurances the U.S. will not do so again.
They have to ensure the Islamic Republic of Iran that what happened in the past is not going to be repeated itself in the future. For that, we need lots of political, legal, and technical discussions. We continue these discussions and these talks as long as needed.
Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov said the differences of opinion between Iran and the U.S. are not many, but they are of principal character. The main unresolved issue at this stage, he said, is how the agreement will be implemented, who will do what, and when. The EU, which acts as coordinator, said the sides are making progress, but that negotiations are intense on a number of remaining issues.
The EU will continue with the talks with all the participants to the JCPOA and separately with the United States to find ways to get very close to a final agreement in the coming days. Thank you.
Araghchi said he did not think the sides could come to a final conclusion in this round, adding that Iran would continue negotiations as long as necessary and until its key concerns were addressed. Homar Izgi, Vienna.
Iran has unveiled a book titled Golan. The book discusses the importance of the Golan Heights, from where Israel monitors developments in Syria after its occupation, so it does not tend to lose its control. Speaking at the unveiling ceremony, the Syrian ambassador to Tehran said that to Syrians, the Golan Heights is as important as the Gaza Strip.
We thank and appreciate the publication of such an important book on the Golan Heights. We thank the author of the book, the Palestine Committee of Iran's presidential office, as well as Iraq's Al-Nujaba Islamic Resistance Movement for publishing the book on the anniversary of the Israeli occupation of the Golan Heights, especially when Israel prevented Syrian inhabitants of the Golan Heights to take part in the election. Syria has always stood by Palestine, and the enemy knows that for us every single inch of our homeland is as important as the whole country, and we are always prepared to pay any price to protect our territorial integrity.
This book's the result of my research and studies on the importance of the Golan Heights for the Zionist regime's national security strategy. This book has two parts. The first part discusses the ideology of occupation, and the second part talks about the military and non-military specifications of the Golan region, because the Golan Heights overlook the four surrounding countries of Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, and even Jordan, so it has a special geopolitical importance for Israel.
Meanwhile, Palestinian ambassador to Tehran, for his part, thanked Islamic Republic of Iran for publishing such a significant book, saying Syria has always stood by Palestine.
Syria has paid a heavy price for supporting Palestine. We share a common history. The 1965 revolution in Palestine was generated with the support of Syria, for which Syria came under numerous Israeli attacks. Syrians have offered many martyrs on this path, and we believe that they will finally liberate the Golan Heights from the Israeli occupation.
The Golan Heights has a special geopolitical, strategic, economic, military, and tourism importance for Israel. Therefore, the occupation of the Golan has continued the survival of the regime. But today, the resistance forces have become so powerful that Israel, which claims to have the world's fourth largest army, has surrendered the Gaza War.
In 1967, Israel waged a full-scale war against Arab territories, during which it occupied a large swathe of Golan and annexed it 4 years later, a move never recognized by the international community.
In 1973, another war broke out, and a year later, a UN-brokered ceasefire came into force, according to which Tel Aviv and Damascus agreed to separate their troops and create a buffer zone in the Heights. But Israel has over the past decades built dozens of settlements in the Golan Heights in defiance of international calls for the regime to stop its illegal construction activities.
Syria has repeatedly reaffirmed its sovereignty over the Golan Heights, saying the territory must be completely restored to its control. This comes as the United Nations has emphasized Syria's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Two Iranian naval vessels are sailing across the South Atlantic Ocean in southwest of the African continent. The two warships have sailed for up to 12,000 kilometers over a course of a month now and are bound for North Atlantic. Deputy Coordinator for Iran's Army, Rear Admiral Habibullah Sayari, made the announcement on Thursday, saying this as the farthest point that an Iranian warship has ever sailed to.
For the first time, our Navy is sailing such a longest route. Over the past days, our ships have passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and now that are sailing at this point, they will sail on to reach North Atlantic.
The mission is carried out using two domestically built vessels, Sahand Frigate and Macron Floating Base. Fitted with a large helicopter pad, Macron was formerly used as an oil tanker. Sahand Frigate is a radar evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. The long journey comes as U.S. officials have claimed that Iran's Navy cannot operate in, quote, blue water. By blue water navies, the U.S. military means the ones that are capable of sailing in open ocean at great distances from their home countries and can operate for extended periods.
When we announced that we would sail in the Atlantic Ocean, some countries said that Iran does not possess such a capability. But today, the Iranian army displayed its naval might by dispatching the 77th Squadron to remote waters using its own fully indigenous vessels.
In 2008, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, hailed the Iranian army's navy as a strategic force. The navy then defined new roles and missions for itself. Among them was to expand its presence in the high seas and remote waters, advance maritime diplomacy, and ensure the safety of Iranian trade vessels by maintaining its presence in the Gulf of Aden.
This is the first time Iran's naval ships have set sail this far in open seas. Iranian officials say this is a turning point for the country's naval force, which will help ensure safer maritime trade around the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
It's been called the Sausage War, a dispute between the EU and former member UK about chilled meats, among other things, entering the bloc through Northern Ireland. The Brexit divorce deal signed by Prime Minister Boris Johnson kept Northern Ireland in the single market while it withdrew the rest of the UK. To avoid major disruptions caused by a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland and potentially jeopardizing the Good Friday Agreement, the two sides negotiated the Northern Ireland Protocol, creating the Irish Sea border. At the time, Prime Minister Boris Johnson described it an excellent deal.
So Boris Johnson lied. What compounds this disaster more than any of the other disasters emanating from Brexit is the fact that we're talking about the resurgence possibly of conflict in that part of the world. 30 years troubles ending with the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. And that agreement is now imperiled.
The Northern Ireland Protocol allows checks to be done between Britain and Northern Ireland instead. That means British food products such as meat and milk arriving in Northern Ireland go through border checks to ensure they meet EU standards. But the new system got off to a shaky start. In early February, the EU complained that some goods were entering Northern Ireland without being checked properly. In March, the UK decided to unilaterally extend the six-month grace period on British chilled meats, sausages included, until October. That angered Brussels, who said the extension broke international law and threatened legal action.
Because they understand that this will be playing well for Boris Johnson politically in his Brexit heartlands, so they need to make sure that people know in Britain that they are negotiating in good faith and they're doing their best to make this work. They're willing to go to the nth degree to do so, and they think probably that will highlight how Boris Johnson is not playing he's not playing an honest hand here.
The UK's Brexit minister, Lord Frost, and his EU peer, Maro Sefcovic, are meeting in London on June 9th to discuss the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, with the EU side saying the Commission would not tolerate further failures of compliance by London.
The UK say that the EU is being too strict about implementing the deal, that Europe is hardly going to be flooded with meat through Northern Ireland. The EU, on the other hand, say they're trying to be helpful, but if Boris Johnson doesn't like the deal, he shouldn't have signed it. Said Bourizza, London.
Pakistan has announced a $55 billion US annual budget. The country's opposition parties attempted to block the proceedings of the budget, calling it an IMF-dictated budget and burden on the poor people.
We have come up with budget which would focus on the welfare of every segment of the society. From 1st July, all government employees would be provided 10% ad hoc increase in their salaries.
However, no one among these protesters outside the parliament in the federal capital were willing to trust the government, which linked a controversial bailout package with the IMF about 3 years ago. Under IMF pressure, Pakistan significantly devalued its currency, raised interest rate, and increased tax rates, which led to massive price hike, inflation, and brought down the growth rate.
The government is scared of IMF, and the government and its ministers are helpless. They had agreement with us to provide us our due share in the budget, but they are coming up with a budget which will hit hard the poor people.
Just few months back, the protesters forced the ruling party to ink an agreement with them to provide substantial increase to hundreds of thousands of the government employees. However, now they feel betrayed after government only provided them of what they called an insignificant raise in their salaries. Few weeks ago, Prime Minister Imran Khan sacked his finance minister for towing IMF agenda. Nonetheless, the economic problems are far from over. Pakistan's economy begins to recover with more revenue and more remittances. However, the government is failing to provide relief to the common people suffering from rising unemployment and extraordinary surge in their utility bills. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The COVID-19 pandemic has hampered India's ambition of double-digit growth by 2022. In its latest report, the World Bank has slashed the country's growth forecast to 8.3% from 10.1% estimated earlier. The service sector is the hardest hit, the report added, stressing on higher spending on infrastructure, rural development and healthcare. The ongoing economic turmoil sparked by COVID pandemic has dragged millions in poverty and unemployment.
The damage was already done with the COVID first wave, but whatever was left, second wave devastated it further. It is very hard to find work these days because there is less activity in construction sector.
In recent weeks, the government announced a set of policies related to spending after a pandemic deteriorated the economic prospectus. The central bank also announced measures for micro, small and medium businesses. Over the last few months, India has been struggling with a ferocious second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic with around 400,000 daily cases and thousands of deaths. Hospitals were reeling under shortage of space, oxygen, beds and vaccines. This prompted the government to announce more stringent lockdowns, which resulted in huge economic costs for the world's second most populous nation, where millions rely on daily wages. Migrant workers were the hardest hit.
No matter what it is, the poor people are the ones who struggle most. Rich people have savings, they can survive. But what about us? The second wave has finished everything we had. If these lockdowns continue, we will die.
The government of Prime Minister Modi has faced criticism over handling COVID crisis. The pandemic with economic slowdown has devastated the livelihood of millions in India. The country is also staring at an unemployment crisis, with youth being the worst affected. Observers say to counter slowing economy and unemployment crisis, India needs to launch more stimulus packages and job support schemes the way other developed nations did after COVID ravaged their economies. But fear of third wave in India is creating further doubts if the country is ready to deal with another looming situation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
As EU leaders continue to try and grapple with COVID-19, hundreds of visitor hotspots across the bloc are more like ghost towns due to ongoing travel restrictions. The European Parliament has approved the EU Digital Travel Certificate. It is supposed to be operational by the 1st of July. Seven EU nations are already using it, but some countries say they won't until the middle of July.
The patchwork is still here, the spaghetti of rules and regulations. Dear national governments, it is in your hands to make sure that people can travel freely.
The new travel cert will show if someone has been vaccinated, recovered from COVID-19, or has had a negative test. A large cohort of EU lawmakers are furious that tests will not be free. They claim it is a mechanism to effectively force citizens to get vaccinated.
People struggling financially who don't want or don't have access to the jab will not be able to travel, legislators point out. Tests could also be very costly for cross-border workers. This is all very discriminatory, legislators say.
Free movement of people within the 27-nation EU is supposed to be a fundamental right. The lack of travel is having a devastating economic impact.
Uncertainties remain, as the near-term economic outlook continues to depend on the course of the pandemic and how the economy responds after reopening.
Official data shows the youth unemployment rate in the EU is double that of the general population, and that might be an underestimation.
I think it's definitely hard, especially if you start working after studying. I had a lot of friends, even with a good diploma, that had some problems in finding a job, like my brother, for example.
The job market is not very high, actually, so, yeah, I mean, COVID, of course, increases this situation, but we are scared anyway.
The EU travel certificate is being hailed as a tool to jumpstart the bloc's economy, but many lawmakers have data protection concerns.
This crisis is being misused in order to get unpopular things through the back door. These doors should remain shut. The certificate should in no way be used to assert control.
Amid growing fears over people's jobs, the European Central Bank has again appealed to EU leaders not to dither over the deployment of COVID-19 recovery funding. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israeli forces have shot dead some Palestinians in a pre-dawn raid in the city of Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin to carry out an arrest operation, according to the Israeli military. Outside the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority's military intelligence, a shootout erupted between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian security forces. During the operation, Israeli forces killed Jamil Al-Amouri, a member of the Jihad movement and a former prisoner, and also arrested another operative whom Israel claims it was looking for both.
What happened in Jenin is a new crime. Israel has got crazy after facing resistance by the Palestinians in Al-Quds, the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Now it's seeking to show its strength by more killings. It thinks that these killings would prevent the Palestinians from continuing their struggle, but the Palestinians have shown that they won't give in to pressure.
Palestinian factions from across the political spectrum called a general strike in the city to mark the deaths of those killed. Thousands of mourners turned out on the streets in Jenin City to take part in the funeral's procession of the security officers. A third funeral has not been held, as the Israeli forces had arrested the third man before he succumbed to his injuries.
There are orders from the Israeli authorities to accelerate the situation. Netanyahu doesn't want to leave office. He doesn't want to be imprisoned. That's why he wants to make an escalation. But Israel must know that it would pay a high price for its crimes.
The Palestinian presidency has meanwhile condemned the Israeli operation in Jenin, with spokesman Nabil Aburdena holding the Israeli regime responsible for this escalation and its consequences.
Israeli forces have not yet handed over the body of the third Palestinian killed during Jenin raid, Jamil Al-Amouri, a former prisoner and member of the Jihad movement. And now Tel Aviv withholds the bodies of 79 Palestinians in its mortuaries, claiming they were killed for operations against Israeli forces. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Scientists and workers' rights advocates were among those who denounced the Biden administration's new workplace safety rules regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, which were unveiled months later than expected and which the Labor Department made enforceable only for healthcare settings, leaving grocery store employees, manufacturing workers, and others vulnerable to the continuing public health crisis, critics said. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading Shameful Failure. Biden's OSHA excludes most workers from COVID protections. Stay tuned for more. Scientists and workers' rights advocates were among those who denounced the Biden administration's new workplace safety rules regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, which were unveiled a month later than expected and which the Labor Department made enforceable only for healthcare settings. leaving grocery store employees, manufacturing workers, and others vulnerable to the continuing public health crisis, critics said. At a recent hearing of the House Education and Labor Committee, U.S. Labor Secretary Marty Walsh told lawmakers that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration OSHA final COVID-19 emergency temporary standard ETS will apply only to healthcare workplaces, requiring those employers to provide their workers with a safe and healthful workplace free from recognized hazards that are causing or likely to cause death or serious physical harm. Except for workplace settings covered by OSHA ETS and mask requirements for public transportation, most employers no longer need to take steps to protect their workers from COVID-19 exposure in any workplace or well-defined portions of a workplace, for all employees are fully vaccinated. Read OSHA new guidelines updated recently. Employers should still take steps to protect unvaccinated or otherwise at-risk workers in their workplaces or well-defined portions of workplaces, the guidance says. But, as HuffPost reported, this portion of the guidance is essentially voluntary. Walsh told members of Congress the Labor Department tailored a rule that reflects the reality on the ground. The success of all government vaccination efforts, plus the latest guidance from the CDC on the changing nature of the pandemic. Science tells us that healthcare workers, particularly those who have come into regular contact with people either suspected of having or being treated for COVID-19, are most at risk, said Walsh. Actually, science tells us highest risk is in food, agriculture, manufacturing facilities, and transportation logistics, tweeted Dr. Kirsten Bibbins Domingo, chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco. A study done by researchers at a university earlier this year showed that American line cooks, warehouse employees, agriculture workers, bakers, and construction workers have the highest rates of mortality from COVID-19. In addition to excluding many vulnerable workers from the ETS, the Biden administration released the guidance weeks after it was expected in March. The Labor Department missed the crucial opportunity, said the National Council of Occupational Safety and Health, to protect workers that President Joe Biden had previously criticized former President Donald Trump for not safeguarding VIDAN ETS. Jessica Martinez, the group's co-director, said this is a new insult on top of the injuries, illnesses, and deaths suffered by frontline workers and their families. Vaccines have not reached all workers and COVID-19 is not over. Journalist Paul Bless denounced the new guidelines as horrible and embarrassing. Oxfam America said the long-overdue ETS represents a shameful failure of leadership by an administration that was elected on a platform of standing for the needs of all working people. We've learned over decades that employers, especially in low-wage industries, rarely choose to prioritize their workers' safety. We need government to mandate actions that safeguard lives and well-being, said Gina Cummings, vice president of Alliance's advocacy and policy for the group, adding, to rely only on unenforceable guidance is almost certainly to condemn workers to face exposure to this potentially deadly virus.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of Imam Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, both from the Islamic House of Qom. Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for inviting
You're
me.
You're welcome.
Here.
And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So, June 18th, 2021 is the day that the presidential election is going to be held in Islamic Republic of Iran. And what is interesting is that in the Islamic Republic of Iran, the term republic refers to the role of the people in their own fate. One of the things which is very important in establishing the fate of the people in this country is voting for the president. And the interesting point about the voting system in Iran and the elections is that every vote is counted. It is in contrast to what's happening in the Western world, like electoral college, you know, votes or something like that, state votes or something like that. Every vote and every person can vote. You know, a person who is that's right,
eligible.
Mature, eligible, 18 years old, isn't it?
Yeah.
18 years old. We can say can vote. Every 4 years, a new president is going to be elected as the president of Islamic Republic of Iran. The leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, in his latest speech, very much emphasized on this Jumhuriya aspect, or the republic, or the people's role aspect of the elections, and the role that the people have in, discerning their own destiny and fate of the future of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, let's start with you, brother. So, this type of election in Iran, how do you find it different from the other elections all across the world? You yourself had traveled to different countries, okay? And you know the models and the systems over there. What is the main difference between this one and the other ones in the other countries?
Well, if I want to just compare the presidential election,
yes,
with the other presidential elections in the world, because you know we have two types of elections, governance in the countries. One is the prime minister, where the people like choose ministers and then they choose a prime minister from amongst them, and then there is a president election that there are a couple of candidates who comes and they do their own campaign and everyone votes for them. When I compare the president election in Iran and the rest of world, there are some good points about the Iranian president election.
That's right.
And one of them is that, you know, when a person has been elected, the rest are generally submissive to the decision. They respect the decision.
Okay.
Number two, people do believe that their votes are counted.
Mm-hmm.
Because generally in the other countries, we see that if someone has been elected, then these kind of things started, like the discussions that my vote wasn't counted, or there was a kind of, you know, we can say a fraud, or the person was pre-elected and these kind of things. Yes, in the anti-Iranian regime, we do see these things about Iran. But within Iran, we don't see such things. Within Iran, yes,
right.
The media which is propagating against the Islamic Republic of Iran, yes, they talk about all these things, but that is not the criteria,
mm-hmm,
to see. It's the general public.
Okay.
And when people choose someone, obviously they know that when they vote someone, they know that it's been their vote, and the way they participate with the energy which they have. Generally, you know, when it is election, they show from the morning, like the show starts from the morning on,
yes,
the TV.
This time is 7 in the morning till 2 at night. At night.
Yeah, midnight. It's sometimes
midnight.
Midnight
because of the coronavirus, you know, the time is extended in order, people...
To prevent people staying in lines.
Yeah, staying in lines or big lines, you know.
Too close to each other.
Yeah.
So we can see, a big public.
Yes.
queued in the line for the elections.
Yes.
Sometimes we've seen families. You know, generally people just go and vote and come back.
Mm-hmm.
Here we see families, small kids.
Yes.
They're with the parents.
Okay.
And the parents are teaching how to do this.
Yes.
So this is very important. And this thing shows that, you know, when it is said it's a religious obligation upon them to select a true manager for themselves, they're really doing it. And on the other hand, there is another view which I have seen in the people of Iran. And that is when we ask them, like, why are you gone for voting, for example? They say it is an obligation upon us, number one. Number two, it's we want to basically show our enemies
mm-hmm.
that this is our power.
That's right.
This is us.
Mm-hmm.
That if you say that there is a need of change of regime in Iran, in the elections we come and we show that there is no need of change in the regime.
That's right.
We are here. We are present here with the maximum number of people.
Yes.
Participating in elections
okay.
to show that the majority of people do not want any change in the regime.
That's
and that's
right.
what we can see. You can see also in the Western media or the media which is doing propaganda against Iran that they're talking about. For example, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we had this election in Syria.
Yes.
The Bashar Assad's,
yes.
he won with the 90% of, you know, votes.
Yes.
And that was a big victory for Syria. Because, you know, the Western powers, they're talking about the change of the regime in Syria. And then the people of Syria, they showed that we do not want any kind of change.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that election actually brings immunity to the
yes.
system and the states.
Yes.
And elections, presidential elections in Iran is a guarantee to the whole system. I think to the Islamic Revolution of Iran, a kind of confirmation for that. But the case is that, you know, somehow... even inside Iran, the people are comparing the presidential election to the Western models, and I think that the Western model is not applicable in Iran, because it, you know,
if they're comparing
democracy
mm-hmm.
and based on the free liberal capitalism, they have their own models, but Iran
you know,
is not successful.
The main problem is people do not know about the election system of the West.
West, that's right.
You know, for example, in France,
yes.
if there is a presidential election, there is a committee.
Yes.
There is a council
yes.
who checks the ability of candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, I think, 6 or 9 people. Like every president who's been president, ex-president, is part of that council. And other than that, there are like 3 other people who have been selected. So these are the people who basically check the eligibility of these candidates.
That's right.
And if the candidate has such abilities or he is eligible, he fulfills the conditions, then he's allowed to participate in the election. Same is the case in Iran. We have the Guardianship Council
That's
who
right.
checks the eligibility of the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when we want to have like election, like as in West, there are certain points, but that is not highlighted in the news from themselves, like from the Western media, we can say. In Iran, because everything is Islamic, and obviously this is very important, that a person who wants to become a candidate should be eligible, should be, for example, you know, his zahir, his apparent, should be, you know, someone who's following the Islamic laws, and he's submissive to that, he respects it, he has other conditions as well
That's
that
right.
are mentioned in the constitution.
Yes.
So you should fulfill that.
Okay.
Because it's Islamic, so in Iran, everything has been highlighted from the guardianship council
yes.
to the level like when they have a time, a week or two for, you know,
for
appeal.
Campaigns
yeah,
or
for appeal and
yeah.
after that is a time of campaign and
yes.
there are like dialogues
and
all those, debates and all those.
That's right.
So because everything has been made apparent
okay.
in Iran,
yes.
that's why maybe some of people in Iran, because they're unaware of what's happening in the West,
mm-hmm.
that's why they might say, like, we want the system as in the West. Whereas if you bring the Western system, then the candidates will be lesser than what you have right now
mm-hmm.
In the elections.
Yeah, I think, and this is not the point, because, you know, even in the West itself, I think there are some differences between, for example, the UK and the US, okay?
UK is a and also the other prime European minister.
Countries. No,
in UK, we have a prime minister.
Yes, I know, and the other European countries. Yeah. But, you know, an Eastern country, a Muslim land, has its own system.
Yes.
And the good point about Islamic, this type of election is that it could be a role model also for other Muslim countries.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
This could be a role model, we can say, and a model, a new model that observes Islam and keeps track on the right, on the path of Islam. At the same time, the people's votes are counted, because some people say that when you have the system of velayat-e faqih, what is the role of the people? But they don't know that, you know, this velayat-e faqih that we have now, Ayatollah Khamenei, here and there, on different occasions, has emphasized on the role of the people,
mm-hmm.
that they might have, we can say, in establishing their own
it's
future.
It's very important that yes. Waliyul Faqih himself is involving people in the decisions.
Yes.
So that tomorrow, if something is happening, mm-hmm. you know, it's very easy to blame one person.
Okay.
And say, like, it's because of you.
Mm-hmm.
But when we are involved in such a decision, then yes. it's very hard to do that.
Okay.
We cannot mm-hmm. back up from the
That's
things
right.
that we have, the decisions that we made. We cannot back.
Yes.
So it's very important. And it's also a good way of, you know, ruling or governing
That's right.
a place so that everyone is involved.
And we are, I think, somehow, how can I say, we are unexperienced, because 40 years have passed the Islamic Revolution of Iran. People are still are in the process of tests and trials, okay? So day by day and, you know, president after president, we will get to the high qualified president that would be approved by an Islamic system. This is, I think, natural and normal.
I just remembered when you said 40 years, you know, in some of the narrations we have, the man's, mental maturity
or
intellectual maturity comes after 40 years.
Yeah.
So these 40 years, the things that happened in Iran, the president election and the presidents that you had, now some kind of maturity has come in the people, inshallah.
Yeah, but I think, again, that portraying the people's participation, you know, every 4 year, when the presidential election is held in Iran, the foreign press are over here. They have conferences over here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they are recording the people's participation in the votes and the voting system and the votes, you know, on the polling stations. But the case is that when they get back to their own media, a different picture is shown to the people.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the decisions that have been made before selecting the candidates who are going to be the president of Islamic Republic of Iran. And this media, I think, has influenced the people inside Iran too, somehow. I do want to say, again, getting back to this Ahad-e Millat, that, you know, when we say this Ahad-e Millat, I mean every person among the nation has a vote, okay?
Yeah.
And this vote is respected. But some criticisms are made by the Western media that before holding the elections, these votes are clear.
Mm-hmm.
And I think controlling the mechanism of the voting stations and the voting system is something which is done by Islamic Republic of Iran. Do you accept this criticism, brother?
It's a wrong, actually, impression that actually they want to put in the minds of the people through their media empire that they actually always active over the Iranian people and Iranian nation.
That's right.
But here we clearly see that people are free in their votings, and they actually find it as their own right to vote whenever they are interested. And there is no sort of prevention from the government or pressure from the government to ask a group and to vote and not to vote. So we see it, but the picture and image that they are actually making from the Islamic Republic is something that is twisted, and everyone, at least inside the country, know that. But since they are more active in the media, so they usually and naturally propagate what they believe in. But we see that much elections that we have had in our country can really be seen in the most developed and, let's say, as they claim, the most democratic countries as
That's
well.
Right.
So more than 40 elections in almost 42 years is something surprising.
Even the villages in Iran and the rural areas,
even
and the navies on the sea, and you know,
we have heard from
the
candidates.
We have heard
from the candidates of presidential election that we send helicopters to take the villagers' votes.
That's why we do that.
Yeah, this is what is being done here.
Yeah.
I don't know if the same procedure and process is being practiced overseas in all these countries that they're actually their voice of equality and justice has deafened the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it is being practiced, but here this is what we do.
Okay.
Once, let's say 10 years ago, actually I was involved in the election process and I see how difficult it is for those who are going to the villages to collect the votes of the people. And usually people are totally free to vote for whoever they like.
That's all right. And the mosque as the polling centers for Iran, you know, in Iran's system of polling station, that they select the mosques in neighborhoods in order to go there and vote for the president. This is really beautiful, you know, makes the mosque again as the societal and the social role that the mosque may have in adhering and showing the people together. This is really
very
beautiful.
Yeah.
What is
these are
happening.
Beautiful scenes that we can see in the elections, mosques and what we call them Husseinias, the places that people gather for Islamic assemblies. These are the places usually.
Also, the gathering between the young people, you know, in the presidential elections before that, before coronavirus, I mean, the previous rounds of presidential election, usually the young people used to chit chat and debate inside the mosques.
Mm.
After the prayers, okay, sitting together, talking about different candidates from two opposing sides, okay?
Yeah.
And about their plans. And this is really beautiful. Okay, thank you very much, Brother Adi
Aradian
and
Said
Mohsen Nawi, for your nice elaboration regarding the role of the people in establishing their own future through presidential election. Iranian presidential election this year is held on June 18th, 2021. And the people of Iran, inshallah, will participate in this big, we can say, political scene of Islamic Republic of Iran. This was what we tackled through the speeches and the thoughts of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the program Viewpoints. Dear listeners, you can visit our website and this program, other episodes of this program, at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page under the title Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.